Hello and welcome to ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, the radio show where events of history are examined through the discussion of books, journal articles, papers, and presentations. Then historians and history buffs ask the question, what is relevant or irrelevant in today's world? My name is Jay Swords. This is the 553rd show of ROI, and our guest today is Dr. Robert Jones, staff member and tutor at Advanced Studies in England and visiting scholar in history at Franklin and Marshall College, who is going to talk to us about his book, A Cultural History of the Medieval Sword, Power, Piety, and Play. Joining us for the second segment of the show will be our history buffs, Rick Sweet and Brett Menard. So to begin with, welcome to the show, Rob.
Nice to be here. Thanks for asking.
We are very excited. It's always fun to do a show about my name. So, we'll try not to make this be any more about me than we can, than we have to. But our first segment is called Farouk Dinaran, and we really just want to give our listeners some background information. So can you start us off with some basic information on what a medieval sword is and how it's made?
Well, okay. It is a blade with a grip and a guard, which is generally referred to as a cross because it runs at 90 degrees to the blade, and then a pommel, which is basically the weighted bit at the back end, which balances the blade off. So those are the elements of it. What makes it a sword rather than a knife is really complex, but basically it's big. In theory, it should be. We're looking maybe 2 feet long in the blade or longer, and some swords are much, much longer, coming up around 4 or 5 feet and more. Some are a little shorter. It's a weapon. It's a tool designed primarily to kill other men, other people, although it can also be used as a hunting tool as well. It's also a lot more than that. And that's basically what the premise of the book is, how much more than a tool for killing people the sword is. And that, I think, is pretty much what I'd say a sword is.
Okay. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you make a sword? Because I think for most of our listeners, the image of the 80s movie Conan the Barbarian, where you've just got a channel and you're dumping molten iron into that, when it cools, and when it cools, you got a sword. That's the image I think most people have in their heads. That's not the image of what a sword really is.
No, that's really interesting, isn't it? So that image of the pouring of metal to make a sword comes out of a much more ancient. Elements of swordsmanship. So the earliest swords are made during the Bronze Age, okay, because the metal of the time was bronze. And bronze you can pour and shape. And so bronze swords are made by pouring into a mold. Iron and steel swords are not. They're made by taking a lump of iron, heating it up, hammering it out, heating it up again, hammering it some more, reshaping, hammer, heat, again and again and again until you get something that is sword-shaped. You then have to quench it. You have to cool the metal in a way that makes sure the metal has the right combination of strength and flexibility. Too strong, too tough, and it will be brittle and shatter. Too flexible, and as soon as you hit someone, it will bend. And that process of sort of the alchemy of sword-making, the alchemy of iron lies behind a lot of the sort of mystical elements of medieval swordsmanship, and why you get that sense in things like Conan of the maker of swords being someone quite magical in their way. But it's a scientific process, it's a complex process, it's not something easily made, and it's one of the reasons that swords, particularly in the early medieval period, are quite high status. They're something not everybody can afford to have. If you go through the medieval period, iron working and iron science becomes much more advanced, and so it becomes much cheaper to work iron and steel, to work the metal, and therefore swords start to become cheaper and they become more widely available, and that then has impact on culture. So making a sword is about hammering iron with hammers, heating, cooling, quenching, and starting the process again.
Well, and just so people, again, because we tend to make associations, what's the difference between an iron sword and a steel sword?
Okay, so the distinction between iron and steel is the component of carbon. So basically, if you think about coal or charcoal, carbon. So when you make iron, because you're heating it in a furnace made with charcoal, that means that carbon gets into the iron. And the mix of carbon and iron changes the chemical composition, it changes the structure of the metal, and it makes it more resilient. And again, the level of carbon within it changes how tough it is, how brittle it is, and that process again is another element. So the making of steel is about managing the amount of carbon within the iron lump that you're creating the sword from. So early medieval swords, predominantly iron, although carbon gets into the mix through the process of making the sword. By the high and late Middle Ages, so from the 13th and 14th century onwards, we're seeing sword blades that are being made of steel. So they're already they're introducing carbon into that iron to make an element called steel. And that's a distinction. And I'm mixing things up slightly because I am not a physicist.
It's okay. We have one of those. Yeah. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah. And I can hear him gnashing his teeth.
So I think the last question I'll ask in this segment is, so swords come in a lot of varieties. We have swords that are, you know, almost impractical that are showing up in video games and so forth and so on. Can you kind of talk to us in briefly, give us a sense of sword styles or sword categories so that people kind of have a sense of just how much variety you can get out of something called a sword?
Yeah, sure. So in the early medieval period, most swords are pretty much the same. They're what you would expect to see of a knight's sword. So it's got two edges and a point. It's to be used in one hand. As you go through into the later medieval period, different forms develop. So you get the development of what we refer to as long swords. Now, these are swords that are designed to be used in one or two hands. Modern terminology, Victorians tended to call them bastard swords or hand and a half swords because they could be used in one or two hands. You then have the next level up is the great sword. And this is something that will stand from pommel to tip, it's maybe 5-6 feet high. And they're designed specifically to be used in two hands. They're huge. Now, that doesn't make them heavy, and this is one of the things that the movies and computer games get wrong, is this idea that all swords, the bigger they get, the heavier they are, the more cumbersome. That's not it. So you've got the knight sword, the arming sword, because it sits on your hip. You've got the long sword, which is slightly longer, the longer grip. You've got the great sword, which is bigger again. And then you have some really odd specialist swords. So you have narrow-pointed swords called tucks, breast stocks, which are designed to pierce the chinks in armor, so they are armor-piercing weapons. And then you have what's known as a falchion. And this is the sort of broad-bladed curved sword. It's got one edge to it, so it's more like what we think of as a modern machete in form. So big, broad blade, often with a sort of cusp edge, so the tip sort of curves back in itself. So either like a modern machete or like what we would think of as an Arabic scimitar. So if you think about the Harem guards in a Bugs Bunny movie, you know, the guy with a big turban, or in the Indiana Jones movie, where he's wielding, swinging that huge, great curved sword around, it's got that kind of look to it. And those are the main distinct type of swords, I think. There are some other specialist ones, so they're specialist hunting swords. And when you get into the very late period, moving into the Renaissance, into the early modern period, so 16th into 17th century, we start to see things like rapiers, right, which are small, narrow-bladed swords designed to be worn as civilian weapons rather than weapons of war, and then into things like tucks and side swords, which again are a slightly different and rather specialist blade form for a different kind of fighting.
All right. Well, as you can see, we have a lot more to talk about, so please stay tuned for the next segment of our show. This is ROI on KALA, St. Ambrose University, 106.1 FM.
In times of joy, in moments of grief, broadcasters come through. Even when all else fails, Today, with more ways than ever to experience the moments that transform our lives, Americans still choose broadcast radio and television more than all other media combined. We are the local broadcasters of radio and television, reaching more people, touching more lives. Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hello and welcome back to ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, the radio show where the events of history are examined through the discussion of books, journal articles, papers, and presentations. Then historians and history buffs ask the question, what is relevant or irrelevant in today's world? My name is Jay Swords. This is the second segment of our show, referred to as the Kitchen Table. Our guest for today is Dr. Robert Jones, staff member and tutor at Advanced Studies in England and visiting scholar in history at Franklin and Marshall College. We're talking about his book, A Cultural History of the Medieval Sword, Power, Piety, and Play. Our history buffs for today's show are Rick Sweet and Brett Menard. Brett, as our resident historian, why don't you start us off?
Gladly. So we'll kind of switch gears to this cultural ideal of the sword. So when a lot of people consume media, they look at swords and they're like, oh, that has to be the best weapon out there. Is it something that is worn and taken up by the nobility because it's incredibly effective, or because, like you said, it's expensive to be able to make it?
I think there are a couple of things going on there. I think the first thing is when the nobility are coming through in the post-Roman period, swords are an elite weapon. They are expensive to make. They require specialist knowledge to forge. Unlike a spearhead, you can make relatively easily. Axe heads, that's fine too. So that's the first thing. So it is expensive to make. It becomes cheaper and they become more widely available. But by that point, it has still built up a kind of sense of its noble position and status. The second thing is that actually using a sword effectively requires training. You can stand a man in the middle of a field and give him a spear and tell him to put the pointy end towards the enemy, and he'll do okay. You can't do that to someone with a sword. They need to know how to wield it effectively. So it needs time, practice, and training. So again, that requires a particular social background to give you the freedom to do that. And I think the third element is, and this one's a little trickier, but a lot of people have argued this, that swords are the only tool which are first and foremost about killing other men. Almost every other weapon that we see on the battlefield that started off as a hunting weapon or as a tool for making things, so an axe, you use it to chop wood, that sort of thing. But the sword seems to have been developed first, and when we see them coming through in the Bronze Age, they really do seem to have been developed in order to kill other men. And that makes it a special object, because that makes it made to break a particular cultural taboo, which is restricted to a particular element within society, that warrior culture. And I think those three things together, so expense, the fact you need to train to use it effectively, and this idea about killing people, I think those three things really do make it a weapon for the noble, a weapon for the military elite.
Okay. Rick?
Rob, you mentioned that the sword started off as a tool for hunting in the Bronze Age. What is the earliest record that archaeologists and historians have found for the first sword? Who had it? Where was it? How they make it?
Okay, so this is outside of my comfort zone, I will admit. But my recollection is we find we find molds for the making of swords in the Bronze Age. So we're looking at the era of the Odyssey and ancient Greece. We find references and we find sword-like weapons in ancient Egypt. So time of Tutankhamun and things like that. So there are weapons of sword form, analogous to the medieval one, going pretty much about as far back as you can possibly go. In terms of sort of cultural identity.
Okay, Rob, speaking of that culture, so if swords require training, then there has to be a culture that provides that training. And so can you talk a little bit about how one went through the process of becoming a competent swordsman in the Middle Ages?
There are two strands to this. So we know less about how noble warriors, so we think about the knight and the chivalric figure, we know less about how they learned swordplay than we do actually about how the middle class were taught swordplay. So the middle class, as you come through into the High Middle Ages, they start to have the freedom to perform pastimes and play games, and one of the games they choose is to play with swords. And that's something that, again, is about aspiration. They're aspiring to be like their betters, like their noble betters, their knightly betters. My suspicion is that if you're a knight, you are learning swordsmanship from other members of the noble household. So that could be uncles, cousins, bigger brother's father, or particular retainers. And you would be taught practically. So you pick up a sword and you swing it at each other in a training way. So you're doing practical experience. There are a couple of references to something called a pell, and that's basically a stake in the ground that you train against. So it'll be a post about man high, and you practice performing cuts against that. It comes out of a very classical tradition. So there's an ancient Roman writer called Vegetius, who writes the book on Roman warfare, or at least how it should be done. And he talks about soldiers training at this stake, this pell. And that's something that's then copied through into the medieval period. So you're doing those kinds of training regimes. Where we know a lot more is about the early modern period, where we start to see fencing manuals, or Fechtbücher in German. And these appear to us to be training manuals. And they'll lay out, this is how you learn to use a sword. They're being written by fencing masters, so men who are telling us, and sometimes they clearly are, they appear in other sources, but telling us that they are men whose job it is to train other men in swordsmanship. And they're sort of professional fencing coaches, if you like. And there we're seeing a very different style of teaching. It comes out of a university tradition, because the kinds of people who are learning that kind of swordplay are actually educated men. They've been taught in school. They've learned law. They're often practicing the law, or they're likely to end up going into the clergy. And so, how they're being taught is a way in which they will have learnt whilst they were in school. So it's much more regimented. It's much more structured than perhaps is going on in the noble households. And so there they're learning a series of moves. So here are the guards you take up, the positions you take up, and here are how you counter those positions. Here are the things you do to draw your opponent into an attack. Oh, and if they do that, you can do this. And sometimes it's, if they do that, you can do this. And if they do this, you can do that. And by the time you got to the sort of counter-attack, to the counter-attack, to the counter-attack, to the original move, everyone's lost their place and he starts again. So it's structured. It's formulaic. It's tricky sometimes to work out actually whether what we're seeing is real training or whether we're actually seeing a bit of a marketing technique. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we'll see particular moves which are quite remarkable, look impressive. If you can charge your opponent down, grab his sword, grapple him and throw him to the ground, looks great. Can you actually do that practically in a fight? Not so sure. It may be here that the master is saying, well, I can teach you something special. I can teach you that one move that's going to win you every fight. And that's a way of him selling the services. And it then appears in the manuscript, and we end up looking at it and going, okay, that sounds practical. We'll give that a try. It'll be all right. What could possibly go wrong?
True. Brett.
So one of the things with swords as markers of status is, a lot of times if you go to the local mall, they'll have these really elaborate swords that have all sorts of fancy stuff on the pommel, might have fake gold or something like that. Is that close to the noble ideal? My sword should be a fashion piece, or were they looking for something more practical?
They tend to be both. So original swords can be incredibly ornate. They can have gilded pommels. They can have inscriptions on the blade. They can have one of Edward III's swords has a little indentation in the pommel, in the weighted end, which has a little piece of crystal, little crystal lens over it, and behind the crystal is a small piece of fabric. And probably what's going on there is that's probably a relic. So that might be, I don't know, a little piece of the shroud of Christ, or a little piece of the Virgin Mary's gown, or something like that. So it can have quite an impact, and then it would be seen and be recognised. But those weapons are very often, when you, if you're able to handle them, and we're lucky, I've been lucky enough to get into some collections where I have been able to pick up some of these very ancient swords. They weigh correctly, they heft correctly, so they have the right feel. They're practical weapons as well as being objects of beauty. And I think one of the dangers we have in the modern world is we assume something is either practical and workaday, or it's a work of art, and that it can't possibly be both combined. And I think for medieval minds, you know, that idea about it being beautiful and practical together work. That being said, if you're noble, you're going to have several swords. And I mean, some lords have, you know, when they come to itemize their goods for things like post-mortem. So when they're working out after they've died what's left in the house, there'll be 30, 40, 50 swords in various forms. So there might be half a dozen in a bag in the back room. There's the sword with the crystal pommel in the best bedroom. There is, you know, a dozen iron swords somewhere else. And it's clear that when they value them, that the quality varies dramatically from very workaday weapons, you know, not costing much more than an average day's labor for an ordinary person, up to things which are almost priceless, and everything in between.
Rick.
Rob, in your book title, after the colon, you have power and play, and I understand that. What is piety and swords? I know J. Swords is a pious person, but in terms of the history of your
book, almost got that out with a straight face.
I know, I worked so hard. I was practicing in the other room. What is piety?
So the sword has always been a very mystical object, and I think often that's very easy for us to recognise today, because we look back through things like Superstition of Fantasy stories, and the weapon has a mysticism about it. So if you think about Excalibur, if you think about Durandal, a weapon of the great hero Roland, or even things like, going back to Conan's sword, it's forged with a kind of mystical element to it, a magical element, a religious element to it. And I think we can accept quite quickly that these things are imbued with mysticism and magic. When it comes to the medieval period, and I started looking at this, it's interesting that actually a lot of the swords we assume are very magical, are not. So Excalibur, King Arthur's great magical sword, actually its only real skill is that it's bright and shiny. And it shines brightly enough that his opponents are kind of bored by it, but that's pretty much it. The scabbard is mystical. The scabbard is magical because it protects those who wear it from harm. But in the medieval period, there's been a cultural shift from the early medieval, where weapons could be have quite a sort of magical, sort of pagan religious element to them. So they have, they often have a story behind them. They have a fate to them. But by the High Middle Ages, of course, with Christianity, they need to shift that. And there's a shift across from being an object of magic to being an object of religious veneration. So we find swords with relics in them. Roland's sword, so the mythical hero Roland, in the poem, the Song of Roland, about this man, it's written down in the 11th century, something like that. He's got about half a dozen different saints' relics embedded in the hilt of this sword, which clearly is serving to direct God's support for his victory through the sword. So it's being used as a kind of as a sort of religious powerhouse, if you like. And many swords seem to have that same thing. So even if they don't have relics in them, we'll see they have pious inscriptions down the blade. Sometimes quite obscure, so there'll be initial letters rather than the whole phrase. But where we've been able to transcribe and decode these, they often relate back to either prayers about protection or prayers about lordship and power and status. But they tie back into these ideas about Christian kingship, Christian knighthood, which are very powerful at this period. So by the High Middle Ages, the medieval knight is very much a Christian figure. He sees himself as a warrior for Christ. He sees himself as part of a Christian ethic. And so the sword is kind of co-opted into that, and the importance and mystical significance of the sword does the same thing. So I think that's where I'm going when I'm talking about the piety of the medieval sword, is to move away from our idea of the sword as a magical weapon and to look at the much more medieval concept of the sword as a symbol of piety and as a conduit for sort of godly power and godly support.
Rob, I'm going to take you back to that slightly more mystical part of the early Middle Ages, because one of the things that has always mm-hmm. fascinated and delighted me is the idea of naming swords. And mm-hmm. early medieval culture, whether it's Celtic or Norse or Germanic, this is very much a part and parcel of a king's power and tying them to perhaps ancestors. You know, we know that the Norse tended to bury swords with people and then dig them up later on in order to be involved in wedding ceremonies and so forth and so on. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, why name a sword? I mean, what's the value of having a name on a sword from the nobility's point of view or from the cultural point of view?
Okay. I mean, from a cultural point of view, it goes back to the idea that in the early Middle Ages, so in the sort of 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th centuries, that period between Rome and what we in the UK generally cut off at 1066, the Battle of Hastings, you have swords which are high-status objects. They're limited in terms of who has them. The ability to make them and the forging process is mystical. You know, this working of iron is not something that is, I was going to say, workaday. It's not something that's normal. It's something that is, the secrets are held quite closely. And so it has a magic to it. And because of that high status and that magic element of the forging process, it means that the sword itself is mystical and magical in a way it ceases to be later in the medieval period. And so, of course, if you've got something of high status, you name it. Sue Brunning, whose book on this period of swords and the ship is excellent, on the early medieval sword, shows that what you actually have is a relationship between the warrior and sword, which is almost alive, in the sense that the sword is very much either an extension of the warrior or actually is a warrior in its own sense. So it has its own fate, it has its own presence. And so, again, it's something you name because it has that energy, that animism to it. So things like Skofnung, which is one of the great saga swords, which goes through about five or six different hands over three generations. It's a weapon which knows when it wants to be drawn. There are particular, you can't ever draw it in the presence of a woman. You must never allow the hilt to see sunlight. And we're not told why. But it's something to do with the sword's soul, if you like, the sword's presence. And so I think this sense that swords could have a life of their own, that they were an extension of the warrior's persona, the warrior's self, meant that, of course, you treat them as living things. And if you treat them as living things, you start to name them. And that sort of, that holds over then into my period, into the high and later Middle Ages, where we see it continuing in the stories of King Arthur, the stories of Roland, which hark back to these earlier times, when the sword was mystical and alive somehow. And so that's why Excalibur continues to be named. That's why Roland's Durandal continues to be named. That's why those swords continue to reappear in the historical narratives as well, because that power and mysticism is really important, and it has echoes down through the later medieval period.
All right, when we come back, we're going to wrap things up, so please stay tuned. This is ROI on KALA St. Ambrose University, 106.1 FM.
You're listening to Relevant or Irrelevant. This series is produced at St. Ambrose University's KALA Radio and has been honored by the Midwest Broadcast Journalists Association and the Iowa Broadcast News Association for excellence in public affairs journalism. You can hear this edition of ROI and many previous programs in this series by visiting Spotify, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, plus Apple Podcasts. ROI airs Friday nights at 9:30 p.m. on KALA HD2 and can also be heard at 106.1 FM in the metropolitan Quad City area. You can stream this show every Friday night at TuneIn.com. Search for KALA HD2.
This concludes our 553rd show of ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant. Our producer and engineer is Dave Baker. Our program manager is Rick Sweet. And the theme song for our show is titled Kayla's Theme and was written and performed by Mark Zapp Zapital. My name is Jay Swords. We'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Robert Jones, staff member and tutor at Advanced Studies in England and visiting scholar in history at Franklin and Marshall College. We've been talking about his book, A Cultural History of the Medieval Sword, Power, Piety, and Play. Our history buffs for today were Rick Sweet and Brett Menard. This is ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, on KALA. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of St. Ambrose University or KALA. We would like to wish all of our listeners to experience the great Basutu proper, Hotza Pula Nala, peace, reign, and prosperity. And remember, historians are horrible fortune tellers. Good night.